This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. There is affordable housing in Bloomington Normal, but not everyone can afford it, and the quality of the housing is sometimes poor.
What we don't have information on is the quality of affordable housing, and those are the soft aspects that we recognize. The data cannot tell the full story.
GLT's Judy Valente talks with the executive director of the McLean County Regional Planning Commission and others as we follow up on our Landlord v. Tenant series. You'll also find out what happened to one tenant who was having problems with her housing and her landlord. It's been a turbulent few weeks for Moesha Tyner and her family as they had to find a new home. And correspondent Colleen Reynolds talks with Kim Wells with the Corporate Alliance to End Partner Violence about the Me Too hashtag and Wells' personal story. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's October 23rd, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Our GLT investigative series, Landlord v. Tenant, revealed the increasing tensions between landlords and tenants among the working poor who are often forced to live in substandard housing. GLT's Judy Valente today talks with three of the people seeking solutions to the affordable housing crisis in McLean County. They are Vasu Pinamaraju of the McLean County Regional Planning Commission, Jeremy Hayes of the Bloomington Housing Authority, and Laura Furlong of the Mark First Social Service Agency, who led a study on housing needs for the League of Women Voters of McLean County. Furlong tells Valente that the League study found three major issues that need to be addressed when it comes to creating additional affordable housing.
One was that there was a need for affordable, supportive, permanent housing for people in our community, that we didn't have enough of that. We also realized that there wasn't just one entity looking at housing. There were a lot of silos looking at housing for disability, housing for families, but not necessarily a global picture of what was happening in our community in terms of that. And so the thought was we really need a body that's going to look globally in our community about housing needs and moving forward on what solutions we might have for housing needs as well. We also realized that there, again, along with that, that we really had a need for global data. There was not a global one-stop shop, if you will, for where what was happening in the housing world. And so it was very hard to get a picture of what was happening in the community as a whole.
One thing that was intriguing about your study was that you found that people make a lot of money in McLean County. However, the cost of rental housing had shot up, as well as the percent of income that people pay for their rental units. What did you make of that?
Well, the recommendation is that people not spend more than 30% of their income on housing. And we found that we had a large population, a portion of our population that spent between 30 and 50% of their income on housing. And we even had a few percentage points of folks that spent more than 50%.
What kind of hardship then does that place on the family? Are they having to balance food, medicine, rent?
Childcare would be another issue, absolutely. So something is going to have to give when you're, and that's why they say that 30%, that's a very common number that you'll hear nationally. HUD uses that number as well. But once you get over that, something has to be compromised. Quality childcare, good nutrition and health for your families, those are things that end up getting compromised.
Vasu Pinamaraju, you work with the Regional Planning Commission. You saw this study. What have you been doing about some of the issues that the League of Women Voters raised?
The League study was very intriguing. That was right around the same time as we were working on Bloomington Comprehensive Plan. League study made it very clear that we have to absolutely look at this regionally. So we were the lead agency, but definitely we partnered with Bloomington Housing Authority, City of Bloomington, Town of Normal, and many community partners like Mark First to undertake the study. At this point, we are towards the end of completing a regional housing study to to understand the comprehensive needs. And like Laura pointed out, one of the biggest challenges that we have in this area is lack of data. While with this study, we were able to gather some really good data that helps us quantify some of the issues that we've heard.
You've shared some of the preliminary results of your study. You have a statistic on the median amount of rent that people pay.
Correct.
But that doesn't tell the full story.
Absolutely. So the good news about this study is it came out and said McLean County is generally affordable. If you just stop at that statement and think about it, we are generally a very affordable community for the most part. But the problem really lies with percentage of our population that cannot afford those rents. But most importantly, the affordable rentals, when we talk about apartments at about a median rent of $650 to $750, that is generally considered affordable. But what we don't have information on is the quality of affordable housing. And those are the soft aspects that we recognize that data cannot tell the full story.
In our series, the people that we focused on were people who are working. They have jobs. They're the working poor, and yet they're struggling all the time to pay high rent in housing that is sometimes so substandard that it's crumbling. But what needs to be done to help?
Today, as I sit here and talk to you, I don't think I can tell you that this study has identified all the solutions. But what it has identified as a key recommendation is we need to have a multi-jurisdictional public-private group looking at these issues and addressing these much more holistically than we had in the past. And as soon as the study is presented to our commission, which it is scheduled to be done on November 1st, that's one of the key recommendations that we are going to act on as soon as possible to form a group to start addressing some of these. And one of those could be education and awareness. Many of the tenants, which you have pointed out in your story, probably aren't aware of their rights. The second one is code enforcement aspects, which you also have addressed in your piece. We need to look at those. There are many other things that we should take a look at existing regulations and incentives to see if they're aligned with where we want to go as a community.
Jeremy Hayes, you're with the Bloomington Housing Authority. Approximately how many low-income subsidized housing units are there in our area?
Well, we have two main subsidized housing programs that the Housing Authority administers. The first of those is public housing, and that's a pretty simple direct model. The Housing Authority owns and manages housing units that are available to people who qualify on income basis. We have 620 leasable units in our housing stock in the public housing program. There's another 800 housing choice vouchers that are available, and people commonly refer to that as Section 8. So those two programs provide a tremendous benefit because they both offer safe, affordable, decent housing to people at a rent that is based on their income. So 30% of their income is what their rent is set at. Whether their income is $400 a month or $1,400 a month, their income determines their rent. That's a great resource to families, but there are thousands more families who would qualify for those programs than we have available units or vouchers.
Do you have a waiting list, and how large is it?
So on our public housing side, the waiting list is not tremendous. Unlike in some of the big urban metropolitan areas where there are years, multiple years wait for a unit of public housing, here that wait might be just a few months. It does depend on unit size. Where the tremendous waits come into play is on the Section 8 voucher side.
Why would that be?
Well, vouchers offer the flexibility. You can get your voucher as your family's needs change or your employment, your place of location changes. You can get different landlords. You can find different places to live. And it's an extremely beneficial resource to families who are struggling, whose income fluctuates. But the wait is very long because we don't have nearly enough vouchers that are provided through the federal government, through Department of Housing and Urban Development, to satisfy the need. It's quite simple.
Isn't another problem that the voucher program depends on private landlords private property owners being willing to participate in the voucher program. So how has that been going? Has the number of landlords willing to participate gone up or gone down, stayed the same?
It fluctuates. It fluctuates, and I think it depends in part on the rental market. So the tighter the rental market is, the less incentive there is for landlords to participate, and vice versa. When things are not as tight in the rental market, they may be more inclined to get that assurance of payment through the Section 8 program. In general, we have some great landlords that have been partners and participated in the program and do a great service.
Visu and Laura, feel free to jump in. This question is really for both of you. The city floats bonds. They work with developers when they want a hotel, a downtown hotel built. What is the problem with getting private developers to get more affordable housing and quality housing? Laura, is it a matter of will, lack of will?
I do think it's the data is going to be helpful, because when we go apply for those resources to bring to our community, we have to have the data. We have to say we have this many families or this composition of family that needs support. And so I think that that will help us. I also think it's knowledge about our community. There's certainly tax credits that would be available for developers that don't necessarily have to come through the city. There are state or federal resources that we can bring here. But again, it's that partnership. I think it also goes back to the supportive housing piece. Many people, I'm sure that Jeremy's Bloomington Housing Authority supports and that the study showed us, was that people can be successful in community-based housing with some level of support. That can be anything from budgeting to personal care to successful managing a home if you've never managed a home before. And so we need to, as a community, pull those supports together. So when a developer says, hey, I want to come here, I want to build some accessible units, we have to be able to say, here's the supports to keep those people successful. Could be, again, mental health. And it also could be people who have not managed their own home, own apartment before. And so they need to know how, and this seems very simple, but how do I safely use a stove, an oven, a microwave, a washer, dryer? I mean, those type of basic domestic skills some people need to be successful.
Part of the problem is if you have a large family, one of the families that we interviewed in our series on landlord-tenant, the woman had 6 children. She's now living in a 2-bedroom apartment. That's hard. What about homes for folks like this? There's apparently apartments available, but what about single-family homes?
Well, I can speak to the great benefit of the voucher program is that you have that flexibility. And there are single-family homes that are rented, detached single-family homes that are rented through the Section 8 voucher program. But
how many compared to apartments?
Well, I'm sure the bulk of our units would fall into multi-unit structures. There are some innovative things that are happening around the country when it comes to affordable housing. And I think that's where a group that is focused in on housing at an interjurisdictional level here locally will help to introduce some of these newer ideas.
Mm-hmm. Laura, I see you writing some notes when Jeremy was answering that. What's your take on it?
Well, and I think there's just a couple of things. Our study also talked about people being eligible for housing authority units in the voucher system. So there are some obstacles, like a certain criminal history, certain backgrounds, certain behaviors, and certainly composition of families if there's not units available. And so, again, I think our study and a global look at that in our community will be very important. I think one example you asked about, Judith, was, you know, are there homes available? So there was a recent tax credit deal that was done for a developer to go and take homes that had been foreclosed on and redo those homes and get those ready for our community as a whole. And those were actually put on the statewide referral network as well for people with disabilities or other folks who had specific needs in the community. What I understand is many of those, again, probably lack of knowledge of those people knowing how to access those. Many of those did not necessarily go to people with vouchers or people with needs. And once they weren't, they were on the market for, I believe, 90 days, then they can go to the common public. So I'm not sure those resources were used the way that the tax credit was intended to do.
So there are some creative ways to go about. What else have you heard that other cities are doing that Bloomington Normal could follow as a model, perhaps?
I will add to what Jeremy said earlier about some of the incentives available for developers who I think there is education aspect to it, but then these are not easily navigable. So there needs to be some assistance that developers can use to really take advantage of these.
Assistance from where? From the government, or the local government? Or
I think this interjurisdictional group that's going to be put together, I'm hoping that we start talking about issues like this, because there are several aspects to this that help close the gap between what the market can support on its own and the gap that exists to make these units affordable.
You know, I've only lived in the community 12 years. Some people have lived here their whole lives. But since I've been here, there's so much farmland that's gone to development.
Oh, yes.
And they've gone to these wonderful, big, beautiful houses. Why has not some of that gone to moderately priced housing?
That's actually, as part of our study, one thing that we have found out is McLean County is generally overbuilt, particularly with single-family houses.
Overbuilt, you're saying?
Yes.
With single-family
houses.
Except they're not affordable to the working poor who may need them.
Correct. So there is a mismatch between, for particular underserved population, there is a lack of housing inventory that serves that population. And if you look at the population growth for the past two decades in this county, we have been a very growing community. So the housing tends to be built for a certain market. So we have definitely found that our population growth rate has slowed down, and we do have an overbuilt situation now. Yet there is a mismatch between the size of the household today to the square footage of the houses being added to the market that adds to the overall affordability issue.
Yeah, we don't need to necessarily be building such huge McMansions, is what you're saying.
Yes, and you know, there are a variety of models that actually go to affordability, supportive housing. So there are models out there. We just have to be creative and more explicit and provide the gap that exists. And honestly, this is the first time a study at a regional level is showing that gap.
Well, Laura, in your league study that you worked on, it showed that the median income is relatively high in McLean County.
Yes. I mean, I think as we compare ourselves with Champaign, Peoria, we have a very high income.
I can tell you that most recently, the median family income for Bloomington Normal is $79,600. So just short of $80,000 is the median family income.
That's a pretty high rate, but it's elevated by all the folks who work at ISU, the professors' salaries, and the folks at State Farm, the white collar people.
Right. And that actually gets to, I think, some misunderstandings about who qualifies for the different subsidized housing programs, one of which is low-income housing tax credit, or LIHTC, or LIHTC, you'll sometimes hear it referred to. And that is the number one way that new affordable housing is getting built, is through that program.
LIHTC. And it stands for?
Low-income housing tax credit. You'll sometimes just hear it referred to as tax credit housing. There have been a couple of tax credit housing proposals recently, and they cover incomes that are, I think, much higher than what a lot of people recognize. In fact, it's a great program, but it serves the higher end of the affordable market. What has to happen in a lot of affordable housing programs is there's a layering of subsidy, so that you might have portions of the development that are available to people with incomes that are 50% of median income or 60% of median income, and then maybe you still reserve a small percentage for those that are maybe 30% of median income. And most of the population that are currently served in public housing and the voucher programs, they're down at that 30-40% of median income.
So, what would you say their median income is on average?
We're talking about, I can tell you, in public housing, on the public housing side, we have a median family income of around $11,000.
So there's a huge gap between
that gap.
And what we're saying is the median income for the county as a whole. And that directly relates then to the cost, the rental prices that landlords are charging. Now, on the league study, you found that McLean County was $200 more than Peoria and more than Champaign, more than Macon County even, more than Sangamon County.
And I think if we look at Champaign as well, you look at those university communities, and we've seen that here locally. We've seen a lot of lovely developments for student housing that are not the people that Jeremy's talking about who have the 11,000, you know, family income a year. So,
and the folks that we met in doing our landlord-tenant series, they were paying fairly high rents for very low quality places. How do you deal with that, Laura?
I will do that. So I think we need to think about our expectations for landlords. Should all landlords have a unit or two that is at to meet that lower income level, folks? I think we have to be very cautious at a community to build huge communities or city blocks or whatever it looks like where we've got all people with very low income. I'm not sure from a healthy standpoint that that's really good for people who would need supportive housing and to be successful. So I think we need to think about spreading people across our community so we can learn from each other. And I think that that's a very key piece. So I really don't want to see us say, hey, we need seven high rises where everyone's going to be at that lowest income level of 11,000. Because I think that will cause us to have different issues not really allow us to have those supports in place for people to be successful in housing.
Another theme that kept coming up with folks who are low income and renting is landlords have the upper hand so often. How do you feel about the way the law is written? Are there adequate protections for low income renters? Let me pose that to Jeremy.
Well, there has to be awareness, obviously. I mean, tenants need to be aware of their rights.
Well, how do we make them aware of their rights?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, Prairie State Legal is our sort of go-to legal aid organization in town, and they do make a lot of effort to do outreach. It can't be at a time when you're in a crisis as a tenant when you start to figure out problem solving. Unfortunately, people do try to occasionally do things where they withhold rent, and they are so, in such a crisis that it's hard to figure out how to respond. I mean, we have them as a resource in town. Both of the municipalities obviously are involved in, with code enforcement. It's hard to slowly build the knowledge out there about how tenants can protect themselves and how they can have a cooperative relationship with their landlord. I mean, that's part of what I do every day is working with tenants. And we say, communication is the key. And it has to, of course, also be met on the landlord side with some understanding and some efforts at communication to cooperatively solve the problems that come up.
One final thing. There are people who are sitting in their comfortable homes who worked hard to pay for those homes who might be saying, why should I care about this? Why should my tax money go to helping a developer build housing for lower income people? How do you convince the taxpayers of this community that this is important? This is an important use of their tax money. Jeremy, I see you wanting to jump in.
Right. This is an issue that actually touches everybody much more than what they realize. It's the people who take care of your children, the people who care for your elderly parents, the people who take care of you at the grocery store, who do a big chunk of the service jobs in the community that really need some sort of assistance in the form of subsidy or on the development side, creating the developments where they can afford. We can't afford to just dismiss a big chunk of our economy, both as employees and as other consumers too. We can't just dismiss that chunk of the economy. It benefits everybody.
Laura?
Yeah, and I agree. If we don't invest in that workforce, we're going to have gaps all over our community and have needs that aren't met. I think we also need to consider that people who don't have housing are going to require a higher level of service. They're going to end up in the ER. They're going to end up homeless. They're going to end up needing very much more supports. And so I think it is an investment up front that saves us money in the long run.
As a community, this is a more sustainable way of growing a community. As we look at who we are, this is one of the fundamentals of how a community should grow.
Thank you, Vasu Pinamaraju, who is with the Regional Planning Commission for McLean County. Laura Furlong is the CEO of Mark First. She also also headed a study for the League of Women Voters of McLean County on housing needs. And Jeremy Hayes is the Development Director for the Bloomington Housing Authority. Thanks so much to all three of you. I'm Judy Valente.
The Regional Planning Commission is expected to discuss findings from its two-year study of a variety of needs, including gaps in the county's existing housing stock, at a meeting on November 1st. Find the four-part series, Landlord v. Tenant, at our website, WGLT.org. I'm Mike McCurdy at Sound Ideas. One of the tenants you heard in our investigative series, Landlord v. Tenant, was Moesha Tyner. A mother of six, Tyner was living in a three-bedroom unit at 705 South Center Street in Bloomington where windows were missing, the bathroom floor was sinking, the front porch was falling down, and there was a roach infestation. She withheld rent from her landlord, Cynthia Shepherd, hoping she might fix those problems. Instead, Tyner received an eviction notice from her landlord and had to move out in September. GLT's Judy Valente has this update on what happened to Tyner and her children.
It's been a tumultuous couple of months for Moesha Tyner and her six children. After her landlord evicted her from the Center Street property, she had trouble finding a new place to live because the landlord had reported her as a bad credit risk. She was forced to pay a $30 fee each time she applied for a rental, only to have her applications rejected in several cases. Finally, she was able to find a landlord willing to rent to her at the Gulfview apartment complex in North Normal. She and her six children are now ensconced in a two-bedroom unit there, for which she pays $595 a month. She says she's happy. There aren't roaches in her current apartment, and her new landlord, Kaufman Real Estate Consultants, even agreed to waive the application fee for her. But she has had to quit her $9-an-hour job at Walmart because her three preschool-age children all have elevated lead levels in their blood and are frequently ill. One was recently hospitalized. Tyner's former husband tries to help, but works only day labor jobs. Tyner says every day is a struggle for survival, but she's happy to have a roof over her head.
It was very difficult because I couldn't find something that would hold for my six kids.
Your landlord put on your record that you had been evicted from your previous location. How did that affect you to have something like that on your record that your previous landlord had filed an eviction notice against you?
You had some that said no. It was automatically, no, we can't help you at the moment. And then they got the $60 application fee, and that means I'm out of money. So I was good at $160. It's very hard because they don't want an eviction.
So the landlords will take your application fee of even if they don't rent to you in the end?
Yes, and it's non-refundable.
Non-refundable.
Right, and I did like three apartments with that. The one I have, and his name is Ms. Kaufman, he actually didn't even charge me an application fee because he seen the runaround I was getting.
You're in a building now that's owned by Kaufman Apartments. How do you like where you live now?
I love it. If I have a problem, I just call and let him know, and he gets out there all within an hour. You don't have to wait so long for him to get things done. He makes sure things get done. He makes sure property maintained, and I like the fact that he has cameras around to watch things and make sure things okay and everybody's getting the best satisfaction with their apartment.
Now, you went from a three-bedroom on Center Street, even though there was a lot of things wrong with that floor that you were living on. I remember the sinking bathroom floor and the leaks and the roach infestation and the missing windows. It was more spacious than where you're living now, despite some of the problems that you had there. You're in a two-bedroom. How is that working out for you and your six children?
I'm actually looking for something bigger. I'm just have to save up enough money, but I'm actually looking for something bigger. It's very small, but I appreciate it. It's much cleaner, and it's a good environment right now for them to live in. More happy day is a clean environment now.
No roach infestation.
No roaches, no.
Okay. Your work situation, the last time that we talked with you, you had just gotten a job, $10 an hour, I think it was, working for Walmart.
Right now, I've resigned from Walmart due to the fact that I keep having my kids are sick. I just recently had an incident. My son had woke up out of his sleep, and blood was coming out his nose and his mouth. And he was shaking. And so we had to call the ambulance and have him to come to, take him to the hospital, which we already found that my son was exposed to lead.
Your son was exposed to lead.
Lead is 9.0.
His lead level was 9.0.
Yes.
And what should it be?
Under 5. Above 5 is considered a little high risk. So that's what he has. He is almost to a 10. So it was a 9.0. My 2-year-old daughter, she has a 6.3. And I haven't got the results for the rest of the kids.
How old is your son who had the 9 point?
He's 4.
How are they getting their health care? Do you have Medicaid for them?
I have Medicaid. The only difference is right now what I'm doing is because I have a hard problem like getting them to, like, doctor's appointments. So I have to set up, see what medical van or whatever will come help me out and take them to doctor's appointments. It's, like, been very hard. So I'm getting, like, a lot of runaround and me trying to manage my son, so I have been staying home from work. I feel like I stay home from work to watch over them, because the scary experience the other day with him, it was like it started with 2 nights in a row with his nose bleeding. Then the next day, it was like the blood, it was like chunks of blood coming out his mouth and his nose at the same time, and it was like very the scariest moment ever to see your son shaking, and you can't ask him what's going on.
This is the son who has the 9.0 level of lead in his blood.
Yes.
Do you think the nosebleeds, did the doctor say the nosebleeds are related to the lead levels? Or
they said that that the nosebleeds like cause it from the lead or a seizure as well. It has a lot of side effects along with lead poisoning.
Now, without your job at Walmart, how are you supporting yourself? How are you paying for your rent?
Right now, I'm leaning on family and friends right now to help me support me and my kids. I actually even went to the aid office to see if I can get like 10 or so right now to support my kids until I'm able to get a job and able to get a work and get back into the work field. Very hard depending on other people because I'm used to just working.
How much is your rent now?
My rent is $5.95.
So it's a little less than you were paying at Center Street, which I think was $700, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
But it's tough to take care of 6 kids and yourself on
that
without an income.
Without an income. And then I'm dealing with, like, it's getting cold outside. We have to be in there. We have to leave, like, furniture and clothes and everything and coats. So what I've been trying to do is look for programs or anything, try to go to donations or whatever, try to find my kids' clothes and their shoes all over again and get back into getting them back together, getting their clothes together. It's hard, but I'm trying and I'm making it.
Where would you go and look for clothes, for example, at Home Sweet Home Ministries or?
Yes, I actually, if I get a couple of dollars in my pocket, I'll try to go to Home Sweet Home and look for, like, jackets or something on sale, or I'm looking for another program to give away coats and stuff.
So of your 6 children, it sounds like 3 are at home, including your boy who has the high lead level, and 3 are in school?
Yes.
Are you getting any help from the father of your children? I know that you're separated. You're separated from your former husband, but...
Yes, he comes in, he gets the kids while I try to go out and look for work for the day or try to take care of some business and try to see what's going on with our son.
And is he working?
No, he's currently not working, but he's lucky. He's been going to, like, express day labor.
Day labor and things like that.
Yes.
It's a tough thing that you're going through. How do you keep yourself going?
Church, I can say. My mom motivates me.
What church do you go to?
I don't have a church home yet. That's what I'm looking for. So I just go to random churches when I can on Sunday, which we just got done talking about me and my mom about just getting in a church, finding a church home. Yeah, I'm looking for a church home right now.
Well, Ms. Tyner, we'll check in with you again, and we surely wish you well on all these issues that you're dealing with at once.
Okay, thank you.
I'm Judy Valente.
Moesha Tyner told GLT's Judy Valente that she moved to Bloomington 2 years ago, seeking a better life for her children than they had in their previous Chicago neighborhood. Things haven't turned out quite as she hoped. Our series Landlord v. Tenant and all of our follow-up reporting is at WGLT.org. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM GLT. Bloomington Normal's Public Media.
NPR's Don Gagne knows what questions to ask to help you understand current issues.
The NRA got its voters out in large.
McCain said his vote today is only to allow debate on the health care bill.
The Senate Judiciary Committee wants very much to talk to Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, and Paul Manafort.
Coming up November 10th, Don Gagne returns to GLT's Radio Faces, and it's your turn to ask questions of the experienced newsman. Learn more at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. The revelations about Harvey Weinstein's decades of behavior as a sexual predator has set off conversations and sparked many opinion pieces about whether Weinstein represents, as one feminist activist put it, the silent prevalence of everyday sexism. WGLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds talks with one woman who has spoken nationally about violence in the workplace, but who has not spoken publicly until today, about her own horrifying experience.
Let's establish what you do for a living and how you were initially tapped by State Farm to be involved.
Okay, thanks, Colleen. Well, I am the executive director of the Corporate Alliance to End Partner Violence, and what we do is work with employers to address domestic violence and sexual assault as workplace issues. When I was approached by some State Farm execs to interview for the position, I had never thought about the intersection of domestic violence in the workplace. But as soon as they talked to me about it, it made a lot of sense to me, because if you have that going on at home, that's going to impact your work life, your home life, your health, all kinds of things. And it's been really neat to see the question change from when I started the job in 1997, companies saying, why should I do something about this? To now, the question is, I know I should do something about this. I'm just not sure what to do.
So you have been on the national stage and have worked with big organizations, the NFL, probably the most prominent, Avon, Verizon, to try to help them with their policies and to change workplace culture as well. And so I'm sure with this Harvey Weinstein story and allegations now from, I think it's up to 40 women, it certainly begs the question, will this, in your mind, as Reese Witherspoon suggested, raise consciousness and really help create change?
You know, I think it will. I think it may be small steps, but I liken it to the terrible video of Ray Rice assaulting his now wife, and that making a sea change in the conversation about domestic violence and sexual assault and what's not appropriate. And rather than people saying, as they would have maybe when I started my job, well, that's a terrible thing that happened, but it's none of my business because it's a private affair, people would not stand for it. And it caused a national conversation about that issue that I had never seen before, and in the community of just people going through their life and people coming forward and sharing their stories. So I think in this same way, the sea change that I saw there, I'm hoping becomes a wave here.
And I think what's going to maybe contribute to that sea of change is definitely the conversations that seem to be sparked by the Me Too hashtag, which has been trending on Twitter. Millions of women, hundreds of men stepping forward to share their stories of either sexual harassment and or sexual assault. And when you first saw that, what did you think?
To be very honest, when I first saw it, because it's something that would commonly be something we would share as part of work or something, I was reticent to do anything about it because, or to post it. I had to really think because I have this very personal experience, and I really sort of had to make a decision in my mind. If I post Me Too, I know what I mean, but nobody else does. Only really my husband knew. And so it was a powerful thing to me, because then I thought, well, if I don't post this, I'm not standing up and talking when that's kind of my job, and I don't want to be silent. And I was amazed at the number of people who had Me Too hashtags. And honestly, of all people, I probably shouldn't be surprised because of the work that I do, but it was still just amazing to see person after person after person after person saying Me Too, men and, you know, women and men, both. It was very powerful to me.
So you first started, I'm imagining, scrolling through, you're on Twitter, you're seeing all of these. Take us through the deliberation process that you had internally and maybe even in talking with your husband about, maybe I should finally reveal what happened to me when I haven't done that, despite the kind of work I have been doing.
You know, it's interesting. I don't know why. This is something that happened to me when I was in graduate school. So it was a very long time ago, and I didn't live in the area at that time. I don't know why. Maybe it was the point I am in my life that I feel more comfortable because I didn't do anything wrong, and so I'm not ashamed. Or it was there. You feel like there's this sea change of people also saying, Me Too, Me Too, and all these people saying, I believe you, that I just felt like it's time to say what happened to me when I didn't even realize that what happened to me was a crime and B, something I should report to my employer. And I can get into more of it if you want me to.
And that's certainly up to you how much detail you want to provide. You mentioned this happened when you were not in the Bloomington Normal community and you were relatively young. So where was this and how young were you?
I was in graduate school, and I had three jobs when I was in graduate school. And one of them was a telemarketing job. And there was a guy who worked on my shift, and I worked in an evening shift because I was, you know, was in school. He attacked me, got me in my car, locked me in my car, and sexually assaulted me. And it's so strange to say it didn't enter my mind to tell the workplace. It didn't enter my mind to tell the police. I didn't tell anybody for a long time, except what I did tell. And this is part of that thing that we talk about. Women have sort of that underground railroad of, you know, avoid this, don't go there, don't talk to this person. I told people stay away from him. And it didn't strike me, I think, probably until I had this job. You know, sexual harassment is a separate important issue, but this was a sexual assault at work, and I was like, oh my gosh, that's illegal. But I think because you put something away because you don't want to think about it and you don't want your life defined by it, that I didn't even sort of have it in my consciousness. And then now, for whatever reason, I could be ready now to say, hey, me too. And this is what happened to me.
So the guy, was he somebody who had made some sexual advances or sexually harassing statements before this occurred?
No, I would say he was the kind of person who would flirt with people, but I didn't have any interest or anything in him. So I was very, and I'm a very friendly person, so I wouldn't think much of a person talking to you. And he was a coworker. He wasn't a manager. He wasn't on my team either. But, you know, you see the person around. So it really was a truly a shock. I mean, it was a shock on many levels. And the thing that bothers me, Colleen, about not saying anything then, and I have to live with it, and it's another reason I want to say it now, is I didn't tell anybody. So I don't know how many other people he might have done this to. If I had said something at work, it might have stopped that from happening to somebody else. And that, to me, is a powerful point about using your voice to be heard, partly for your own experience and partly to say to somebody else, you know, it's not okay if this happened to you, and to make sure that people are safe.
As this is happening to you, what kind of thoughts are going through your mind, or did you sort of
it's
leave
a dissociative,
your body?
Just left myself. I think you've heard people say before, you feel like you're above the situation. And I just kept thinking, when's this going to be over? When's this going to be over? When's this going to be over? And I swear, I don't think the dude, and what's frightening about that is I don't think the guy thought he did anything wrong. I think that's a person, it sounds very SVU-like, but I think he didn't know that that wasn't okay. I mean, I never talked to him again.
When this is occurring, are you trying to fight? Are you saying no? Are you questioning? Or are you just saying, this is happening?
I got to get you through it. I got to get through it. I mean, that was my choice or my decision or whatever. The guy was very big. He was a big, tall, strong guy. And he, like I said, had locked me in my car. And I just thought, I just have to get through this. I just have to get through this. I just have to get through. Because at first you're like, this is a person I know. What in the world are they doing? So, it, you know, that was my choice, was just get through it.
And then you go home.
Mm-hmm. Didn't tell my parents. I was living at home when I was in grad school. Didn't tell my parents. Didn't tell anybody, I think, until I told Mike. We've been married for almost 25 years, so I told him probably fairly early on. And he's a wonderful person to talk to about something like that because he's a wonderfully supportive, caring person. And after that, I think I just sort of put it away.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Colleen Reynolds talking with Kim Wells, Executive Director of the Corporate Alliance to End Partner Violence. Wells recently used the Me Too hashtag and is relaying the story of when she, as a grad student, was sexually assaulted in the parking lot of her workplace. The women who you told, the co-workers, the female co-workers.
That I said, stay away from this guy. He's bad. That seemed to be enough for people, which is interesting. That seemed to be enough for people. I didn't have to say, because he got me in my car. I just said, don't hang out with him. Don't date him.
So you didn't go into details
what
happened?
Mm-mm. I wish I would have, because what I'm afraid of is that because I didn't, that could have happened to somebody else. I wish I would have. But I was at the point in my life I was at. I was in my early 20s. I just didn't even have a concept. I think now, a person of that age now would know, I hope, and more conversations like this, would know that's not okay what happened to you. That's actually a crime, and your employer needs to know. But that's being a 20-year-old brain then. I think things are different now.
Or at least you hope.
I hope they're different now. You know, you were talking about some of the companies that I work with, and I have to say that I know there are places like that, workplaces that are so committed to changing a culture around domestic violence and sexual assault, that I have hope that message gets out a lot more. Gosh, the education that students get when they first come to ISU about sexual assault and where to get help just makes a huge difference.
Not to be too dramatic here, but have you thought about where that guy is today?
Yes, I have. I have thought a lot about it. I've thought a lot about it and wondered and hoped that I'm the only one.
And have you thought about what you would say to him if you
saw
him today?
Oh my gosh, yes.
Do you have the speech in your head?
I definitely do. I just want to say that if this has ever happened to anybody, you know, you're not alone. It is not your fault. You didn't cause it. And when you're ready to talk, there are great places in the community like Stepping Stones that can talk with you.
That's the power of what can happen with a Me Too hashtag, right?
Oh, I think the Me Too, for me, the Me Too was really an intersection kind of turning point for myself about sharing the story. Absolutely powerful. I want to say two things I think are important. First of all, this doesn't just only happen to women. It happens to men. 1 in 6 guys by the time they're 18 has some sort of unwanted sexual advance on them. So that's huge. That's 1 in 6 is actually an organization that helps guys out to deal with that. And I know that the CDC had a study where it was about 20% of guys that in a study they did reported. So it's an everybody's issue, just like domestic violence is. It's everybody's issue. We all need to stand up against it, and we can all do something about it.
You know, lots of people are writing and talking about this, and I have a friend who's a writer, and she wrote a blog, and in it she talked about a male friend who commented that he was shocked about all the women he knew who had posted with the hashtag. I'm actually going to read directly from what she wrote. He wondered how he didn't know how endemic this issue was in a woman's life. And then she writes, I was shocked, but not about the number of women affected. I was shocked. He was shocked. I figured everyone knew that this was just part of a woman's life.
That's powerful. But, you know, it shouldn't be part of a woman's life. It shouldn't be something to just get through. And I feel like if anything happens as a result of the terrible things that have happened with Harvey Weinstein and the stories people have shared, it's that people will stop being shocked and people will start changing the culture.
It is amazing how many high-profile women and even men, I'm thinking of Terry Crews, are telling their stories now.
Yeah, I think that's powerful, too. You know, Terry Crews, if you don't know who he is a giant former NFL football player who's now an actor. And he was just sexually assaulted or groped, or I don't really know exactly how to say it, just a year ago. I mean, this is a big, strong, strapping guy who had this happen to him. And I think that's really powerful because I think just like very much like with domestic violence, people decide it happens to people like this. It happens to people who aren't powerful. It happens to people who it can happen to anybody. And I think that is a good hard lesson.
Do you think that men hearing the Terry Crews story will kind of get it? That here you've got a powerful man who stays silent and doesn't know what to do?
I think that then in itself is really powerful, because I think people do much better understanding something when they can put themselves in the shoes of whatever it is they're learning about. And I think that will make a huge difference too. Yeah.
So going forward, how should men be responding and women be responding to people sharing their stories, and what more can they do to be supportive and help change the culture?
Well, I think that believing people, I believe you, thank you for telling me, that took a lot of courage to share that. It's funny, those are the things I say for people to do for other people, are really important. I think also calling it when you see it, you know, sexual assault at work, obviously, but sexual harassment sometimes can seem subtle, or, you know, that's just locker room talk, but calling each other on that and saying, that's not cool, that's not okay, I'm not going to tolerate it. Because when we do that, when there's the social pressure to not behave that way, or you're going to be ostracized, that also makes a difference inside of the person who thinks it's an okay thing to do.
And most importantly for people hearing this interview, do you want to leave any final thoughts?
I think that if there's somebody out there who's been through this, I just want to say, we believe you. We support you. You don't have to tell your story. That's your choice. I think that's also important, is we shouldn't expect people to share when they're not ready to, or they don't choose to. That's their choice. As much of the control and the power as that person can have in their own life about these issues. But if it's at work or related to work, there are choices with reporting through your procedures at your workplace. There's also the Illinois Department of Human Rights that, you know, looks into these violations, and then the EEOC. I know that's a lot of steps, but I want people to feel like they have choices and they have power if that's what they choose to do.
Well, Kim Wells, a difficult interview, and we really appreciate you choosing to talk with us about it and with our listeners.
Well, thanks, Colleen. I appreciate it.
GLT's Colleen Reynolds talking with Kim Wells, the executive director of the Corporate Alliance to End Partner Violence. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website, WGLT.org, is where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast and the individual stories and interviews from Judy Valente and Colleen Reynolds. We want to know what you think. Post comments about Sound Ideas at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. I'm at Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 FM GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.